This is Rights.Tech. I'm Henrik de Gior. Today I'm speaking with Jim Griffin. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Jim, who are you and what do you do?
Well, my name is Jim Griffin. I am focused on the digital delivery of art and its monetization. And I've done that from two companies that I've been running for quite a while, One House and Hazen LLC. They're an outgrowth of Cherry Lane Digital, which I started with Milt Oken after I finished my work at Geffen Records. So then we created Cherry Lane Digital, and after that became of service to Warner Music Group and ran network licensing for them for 3 years. And I've also worked with an even number of companies in this field as a consultant.
Jim, what are the biggest challenges and successes you've seen with rights management?
Well, lots of challenges, lots of successes. I would say the one that I'm most associated with is delivering the first full-length song online, which was an Aerosmith track called Head First in 1994. That was the first time that a music company took a commercial single and put it online for distribution to its audience. And that was a great success. Certainly, lots of media outlets said the fans were the winners and that this was a dramatic change, and our company was very pleased with it, too. I have to say that while there's been lots of discussion about whether digital music is a good idea or not, we certainly started out from the assumption that it cost us money to put music into the marketplace, and this lowered that cost dramatically and also increased the size of the audience. So I would declare it an unmitigated success. Certainly there are a lot of challenges, which is people understanding the rights situation and the compensation situations moving forward. I would say that that is the biggest challenge, is this balance between compensation as a focus or control as a focus. Keeping those two competing goals, compensation and control, in balance, I think, is probably the greatest challenge that anyone has.
And what is changing with rights management, or needs to change?
Well, I mean, certainly what needs to change is a very subjective judgment, and there are many who would differ on that, I suppose. I think you can start with these two words, rights management. And so, there's certainly an issue there. The first one, rights, is what really are your rights, and are these really your rights, and are these rights like other rights, like, say, the right not to be discriminated against based on one's gender, or the right not to be discriminated against based on, say, one's national origin. Those are rights. If they're violated, you call the police. They will come and write up a report and help address the situation. Certainly, that's not true in our field. You can call the police for as long as you like. The notion that these are your rights is something that you can take up with your attorney and proceed in a civil manner, but it's not clear that these are entirely rights. In fact, I call them risks. I don't like calling them rights because I think it miscommunicates the situation. Certainly, artists and creators and those who work with them face a copy risk as they go into the marketplace, but the notion that these are fundamental rights that are going to be enforced by society is a lot more challenging. And the word management is difficult, too, because it suggests that somehow we can manage them, that we have our hands on them, and that we control them as if it were the wheel of a big ship. But once digitized, zeros and ones seem to find their way from source to destination roughly on their own, without our steering the wheel. So I'd say that what's very, very challenging and what needs to be addressed is the notion that these are our rights and that we can manage them with control. Instead, I like to look at results. In other words, are you optimizing your rights strategy by optimizing the revenue that you receive or the reward that you receive from offering them? That seems to me to be a much more rational approach. Because it speaks to the real issue, which is the incentive to create, the need for resources to create. This, I think, is a much bigger challenge than, say, relying upon one's rights or thinking that if only you find the right technologist, you will be able to manage them. These are misnomers. From my standpoint, I'm sure there's someone out there who would equally and forcefully propose that, no, you can manage them and these are your rights. I'm open-minded to that sort of discussion. It is simply to say that they are not like other rights that we try to put forward, and that managing them is a great challenge in a networked world where zeros and ones seem not to be in control.
Fair. And what advice would you like to share with people interested in rights management?
You know, this totally reminds me of when I started working with security experts, those who would come and help you secure your network, and I became friends with lots of them, and over time, I have changed my point of view with regards to their work, and it has informed me as regards this work. And those people have always said back to me, look, it's not a matter of just tightening down your network or building a better gate or a better fence. It's really about your policy with regards to these things. It's about what you expect and how you expect it to happen. And so they would insist that their work could only proceed once we were clear on what our policies were with regards to these issues. And I would say the same thing is true of rights management, that it is not something that is objective. It's not like we can sit down and say, oh, you managed your digits well, they're staying in place, or they're here, or you know where they are, or you're following the law. I think it's much more important to understand what your policy is with regards to what you think are your rights and how they should be managed. And I think that traditionally we would agree that the measure by which we are measured in all of our work is the company showing a profit? Is there a reward associated with this work? And that is very different than the technical task of, have I made backups? Have I secured my assets? Have I put proper password management procedures? Have I written a rule set for how these things are used? I think it's much more important than that. It really goes down to being aligned with the goals of the company. So let's say you do your job extremely well in a technical sense as regards what you think of as rights management, but your company does not make a profit that year or the next year or the following year. You're going to find yourself looking for another job, or your company may be acquired or looking for something else to do. Because in the final measure, the way we determine whether we did our job well in this field is whether we manage to exact a proper reward for these things that we have invested in. And that requires a much broader kind of thinking that includes one's customers and the marketplace and how we're competing in that marketplace. You know, one thing I don't hear anywhere near often enough, but which is absolutely important to bring up, is that the customer is always right. That's my view. I'm not saying I always agree with them, but they are always right in the sense that they get to decide if they're opening their wallet. They get to decide where their eyes behold something or where their ears listen to something. These are their decisions to make, their discretionary decisions that they make. And we win when we win their attention or they open their wallet. And this requires something much more important than, say, an exacting approach to rights management. And you can see this playing itself out today in the marketplace in any of a number of ways. Let's take an example of, say, a major newspaper that erects a paywall. Maybe they view this as protecting stuff to which they own the rights. And maybe they feel that they are managing it well by ensuring that only those who have paid can see that content. And yet there are any of a number of big publications that are removing their paywall entirely. And why? Because they find that that paywall is costing them money. It's costing them eyeballs, ears, and wallets that would otherwise be taking in their content and seeing the sponsorships and other things that are related to it. So in the final analysis, we have to think about rights management and how it impacts the profitability of the company and how it impacts the company's relationship with its customers. It is much more than a technical task. It is not something that can be graded simply on some kind of digital balance sheet. It's something that involves the perception of the company in the marketplace and the rewards that it is exacting for the content that it is managing.
Great. And where can we find more information about rights management?
Well, this one I think is very, 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 very important because all too many of us are purely quantitative. In other words, we look at the task that's in front of us in digital asset management, and we say, gee, we've got RAID drives, we're doing our backups correctly, we're using appropriate procedures, say, for password management, et cetera. What could we be doing wrong? And yet, what we aren't doing then is going to lunch with the head of marketing or the CEO of the company or the CFO of the company, et cetera. I think the place where we find out about rights management in the context of the work that we have to do is by spending time with our clients, creative time. You know, I've really not seen creativity break out over a conference room table. And yet, I have often seen it happen during lunch or during dinner or during breakfast. And so, I think what I would offer as regards information to those who are thinking about this, many of us very quantitative people who focus upon technology, is to brush up on our people skills and spend more time both inside of the company with which we work and with those out in the marketplace. I have to say the best thing that I ever did was create with John Paris, who has since passed on. We created a set of brunches called Pho that we held at a Vietnamese soup kitchen. And I invited everyone who I encountered in my work to come share a meal with me, and I was happy to pay for that meal. And I'll tell you, that burgeoned into hundreds of people and eventually the Harvard Business School coming to that soup kitchen for lunch. And then it became a listserv in which now tens of thousands of people participate. Now, once you've done something like this, spread your wings, reached out to include people both inside your own company and outside your company in discussions around these topics, you're going to be awash in information about what you're interested in. So I think that it's as simple as that E.M. Forster phrase, connect, always connect. If you're connecting with those with whom you work and others in your field, and listening to podcasts like this is certainly one example of doing so, then you're on the right track. You're going to find out a lot of information. But if you're restricting yourself to book learning and very, very technical notions of the processes and the work that you have in front of you, then I think you are in trouble because you have become so insular that you are the only judge of your work and you are not including those at your company who need your work to make their own work happen. So I reemphasize the head of marketing, the head of publicity, the head of sales, those people who create this great content, this art, really, that you're privileged, that you have this challenge of managing. They're the people you need to be getting the information from. And they're the people that you need to reach out to and spend time with. You know, I have to say, you're a great example because you and I, before we did this podcast, a couple of weeks ago, we met for a breakfast meeting at a wonderful country cafe. And that kind of interaction, I would say, is just essential to us growing and being better at what we do. And imagine how much poorer you and I would both be if we had simply kept our nose down and been coding or spending time in our job. I think we would be missing the point, which is that when we connect with others, when we reach out, we learn so very much about those things that we're privileged to work with. So I think that would be my main takeaway, is to be thinking deeply about the purpose behind what we do and why we do it, and to be thinking about the goals and the effects that that has on the world around us. You know, that becomes very, very challenging when you do that, when you think about how managing your assets sits, say, in context with the library down the street, which might be offering the same materials and offering to lend them for nothing, and entirely legally so. Or to be thinking about how the customer works with these same assets once they've downloaded a song, once they've downloaded a picture, once they've downloaded a movie. What do they do with it? These are the realities that we face, and we can only face them when we're learning about them in context. So, connect, always connect, reach out. The information will come to you when you're forming the right relationship. I have a website at onehouse.com, and people can look there. And really, anyone listening who'd like to join the FA list, I'm delighted to have you on the list. Write me, tell me you're interested in joining. You'll find lots of other professionals who are involved in these same issues, discussing those issues. We've been doing it for almost 20 years now. So reach out. As technologists, I think we need to look to the past. we need to stand on the shoulders of giants and look backwards and say, where do we come from? And where we come from, I think, is the greatest advance in technology before our lifetime, which was surely Gutenberg. The idea that Gutenberg had that, you know, there could be a movable type and that we could set things and that we would then be able to create books and pass knowledge around about where we came from, who we thought we were. This was certainly the greatest development before our lifetime. And I think it's fair to say that we have a challenge in front of us. And it's an opportunity. And that opportunity is to work on a friction-free Gutenberg. That, I think, is what's in front of us during our lifetimes now. And I think that is an extraordinary privilege to do, to be a part of a friction-free Gutenberg. You know, when you begin to think about the implications of this, when you think about how it affects the distribution of knowledge and culture, how it affects the arts and sciences, like medicine, for example, the idea that a medical test may simply be an algorithm that can be transferred over a network, that we can literally use printers to print new medical tests, and even human organs, that as we move forward in digital asset management, that we find ourselves literally working with the building blocks of humankind with 3D printers that can literally create medical instruments the evening before or even the morning of a surgery. Say they need to be especially small for a tiny infant, or they need to be quite large for a big individual, that we can print these on demand. This is stunning that we have this in front of us, that a friction-free Gutenberg has gone from merely words to then, of course, audio expressions and then video expressions and photographs and so forth all along, and that now we are actually able to change the future of humankind through things like new pharmaceuticals and new medical instruments. It is a wow what we have to work with. So on the way out, I wanted to make sure that we mentioned this because it's what gets me up every morning and what keeps me up every night before I go to sleep is that we have an extraordinary privilege to be working on the development of friction-free Gutenberg-like development. So this is extraordinary power, extraordinarily powerful.
Great. For more on this, visit rights.tech. Thanks again.